Hello, this is Terrence McNally. This past week saw China lead negotiations to end long-standing hostilities between Iran and Saudi Arabia. In the U.S., we've seen how even one person willing to oppose the popular consensus can dictate our nation's response to climate change. Here's my 2019 conversation with Barbara Finnemore about her provocative book, Will China Save the Planet?, which explores China's big-picture long-term strategy to seize the leadership of the global response to climate and reap the technological, economic, and political benefits. Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another newly recorded episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Barbara Finnemore, Senior Attorney and Asia Senior Strategic Director at the Natural Resources Defense Council, about the ideas in her provocative new book, Will China Save the Planet? Let me set up this show first by telling you that after a three-year hiatus, once Trump achieved his Electoral College victory, I started doing new interviews every other week. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on her book, No Is Not Enough, Arlie Hochschild on her book, Strangers in Their Own Land, The Stories That Divide Us, Robert Wright on why he's a Buddhist. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, and the podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, whatever you call it, Podomatic.com, Google Play, and 20 other sites. And at my website, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. Now, today's guest. Since the moment that I heard of the book, Will China Save the Planet?, I've been looking forward to today's interview. A little background. For me, the most memorable exchange in an interview I did with Jared Diamond on his 2005 book, Collapse, was when we spoke of China's response to the devastating Yangtze floods of 1998. How devastating? Well, more than 4,100 people killed, 13.8 million homeless, and 240 million directly affected by the rising waters, nearly equal to the entire U.S. population at that time. So the authorities said, why did this happen? The answer came back, it was erosion. Well, why was erosion so bad? The answer came back, deforestation. They said, let's stop deforestation. And in China, basically, that's what happened. And I observed at the time, speaking to Jared, that in the U.S., even if the right choice was made, it would probably take a few years to overcome the timber lobby on the way to getting to the right thing. Well, no timber lobby in China. And we both agreed that despite the darkness of authoritarian rule, they can act for good or ill with speed, change that would take would take much longer here. And now if we look at today, in the U.S., we see how even one person willing to oppose the popular consensus can dictate our nation's response to climate change. While in China, we see a big picture, long-term strategy to seize the leadership of the global response and reap the technological, economic, and political benefits. Barbara Finnemore has experienced China's transformation firsthand. China, the world's largest carbon emitter, is leading a global clean energy revolution, phasing out coal consumption and leading the development of a global system of green finance, as well as being the dominant player in renewable fuels. China's leaders, she points out, understand that transforming the world's second largest economy from one dependent on a highly polluting heavy industry to one focused on clean energy, services, and innovation is essential not only to the future of the planet, but to China's own prosperity. Barbara Finnemore, Senior Strategic Director for Asia at the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC. She founded NRDC's China program in 1996, the first clean energy program to be launched by an international NGO. And she also served as president and chair of the Professional Association for China's Environment and is the co-founder and president of the China-U.S. Energy Innovation Alliance. Will China Save the Planet?, I believe, is your first book. Yes, Barbara?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. And by the way, let me just say right off the bat, it's with Polity Books, P-O-L-I-T-Y. It is a, even with footnotes, 150 pages. So 125 or so. So it's timely information, and it is hardly an arduous read. Will China Save the Planet? By Barbara Finnemore. Barbara, let me tell people first that we're recording this conversation Friday, July 12th. Let me welcome you to Freeform, A World That Just Might Work.
My pleasure to be here.
Okay. And I like listeners to get a feel for the people beyond the ideas and the work that we talk about. And so can you tell us a bit about your path to the work you do. Feel free to go way back. Mentors, turning points, moments of decision, why you ended up in China in the first place, why you ended up at NRDC, those sorts of things, okay?
Sure. Thank you for asking. I majored in environmental studies in college. This was not long after the first Earth Day, so the world was swept up in these ideas perhaps for the first time. But in my senior year, I took a course on environmental law, and there wasn't much at the time, not too many lawsuits, but most of the ones that were on the books were brought by this organization of lawyers called Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC. And right then and there, I decided I wanted to go to law school, I wanted to work for NRDC, and I wanted to sue polluters. And it was a bit of a circuitous route, but I did that. I made it to NRDC. I became a litigator against, actually, the Department of Energy, which ran the world's largest nuclear weapons development program. And so my task was to sue them to help them clean up 50 years' worth of radioactive and toxic waste caused by building of nuclear weapons. And we did it. We set a precedent-setting case that required, basically, the largest cleanup, environmental cleanup, the world has ever seen, and it's continuing to this day. It's such a mess at these 30 nuclear weapons sites around the country. I would probably still be doing that today if I hadn't met my now husband, who was just joining the U.S. Foreign Service, and he was assigned to China. So I went along, and of course you can't bring lawsuits when you're traveling around the world with a diplomat husband. So I was trying to find work to do and ended up as a consultant for the United Nations right around the time of the Framework Convention on Climate Change. And I got a front row seat to China's awakening, really, to the principles of sustainable development and climate change. And I was just hooked. And after 5 years of that, I went back to NRDC, and I said, we need a China program. I see what China needs to get where it needs to go, and I see what NRDC has to offer. And so I was allowed to start a China program like Cinderella in my spare time with whatever money I could raise, which wasn't very easy to do when I was still litigating. I went back to my old job. But within 3 years, my husband was posted overseas again, and I managed to convince NRDC to make me their first international employee. I gave up the litigation. They hired another person for that, and then I started the China program. They said, we'll give you 1 year of part-time. And within a year, I'd raised enough money to just move to full-time doing China work, and that was almost 25 years ago.
Yeah, it's quite impressive. And when you say you were present when China emerged on the international climate stage in 1991, can you describe that situation, that take us there?
Yes. So in 1991, in preparation for the negotiations on the Framework Convention on Climate Change, the Fundamental Climate Treaty, China called ministers from 40 other developing countries to a conference in Beijing at a big hotel ballroom for the purpose of coming up with a joint negotiating strategy for developing countries. And I was lucky enough to be in the room for that time as a UN employee. And that was the moment when China stepped on the international stage as the leader of the developing world and really pushed forward a set of joint principles that found their way into the Framework Convention. And these include the very fundamental principle of common but differentiated responsibilities for developing and developed countries. China believed, and so did the others, that the U.S. and other developed countries had the lion's share of the blame for all the CO2 emissions they'd been pumping in to the world's atmosphere for years, and therefore they should bear the lion's share of the efforts and obligations to mitigate their emissions. So it was fascinating for me to be there at the very beginning of China's real leadership in this effort on behalf of developing countries.
And when you say that common but differentiated, it's that point you made that there would be a different demands, different expectations, different commitments from the developed countries than the undeveloped. But the other crucial thing for China was that all developing countries be in the same bucket.
Right. And in the beginning, that made sense. China was still lagging far behind in terms of its economic development in the early 90s. So it was pretty much made sense to to count China as one of the 60 other developing countries when looking at climate treaties. But, of course, starting in around 2001, when China joined the WTO, its economy just took off in a way that the world had never seen before. It just quadrupled its GDP in one decade, and it nearly quintupled its exports, and it was all powered by coal. And ever since that time, as China's economy continues to grow, it's become harder and harder to lump China in with the rest of the developing world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we will talk, I'm sure, about the fact that at this point they are the world's largest emitter, which I've mentioned. But let's go back to, you found at in the early stages that there was an awareness of climate change, but it was not on China's agenda. And so in your earliest work, you seized instead on energy efficiency because of what was happening for the people in China, not climate change, but what was happening in their air, correct?
That's right. So in the early days, we really couldn't talk about China's rapidly growing coal use, and we really couldn't talk about climate change. These were considered sensitive issues. But the way in which China was growing so fast was so wasteful that it was leading to widespread power outages every summer because they couldn't build new coal plants fast enough and because they were using that coal so inefficiently. So it was when these power outages started to really affect people's lives and also their economic growth, because they were having to shut down factories periodically or just require them to operate at night, that the Chinese government came to us and said, now tell us what California is doing, for example, leader in energy efficiency. How can we use efficiency to grow in a sustainable way?
Right. In other words, at that point, California was demonstrating that if you were serious about efficiency, you could grow your economy without growing your emissions.
That's been our central message in China for all these years. Absolutely.
Okay. And let me just, one note I want to say is that you've shifted your work a bit at NRDC. You're no longer leading the work on China and now a strategic advisor on work throughout Asia. Why the change and how did that change intersect with the writing and publication of this book?
Our Beijing office was originally, I like to say, one man with a cell phone for about 10 years. We were so small that I could keep growing and running the program, regardless of where I was living. And I continued to follow my diplomat husband all around the world. Mm. But we got to the point where it was too big. We now have 50 people in our Beijing office, including attorneys, including environmental activists, including scientists, and it just not working anymore. So I gave up the position of running the office day to day and left it in the capable hands of our current China program director, Jingjing Qian, who is from Beijing and is there in the office every day leading all these people in a whole variety of projects.
Okay.
So I moved to the position of strategic advisor, strategic director for all of our work in Asia. And as a result, that's given me a little more time to write this book.
Mm-hmm. And how did this book happen? As we said, you've been working in the field, you've been present and involved in a lot, but you decided, I'm going to write a book. And this is a daunting challenge for many people. What happened?
I did not decide to write a book. I was approached by a publisher, by Polity Press in London, to write a book as part of their series on environmental futures, a series of short books, each with a provocative title, like Will Big Business Save the Planet? And so they approached me, and I said, no, I'm way too busy actually working on the ground to make things happen. But let me just say they were very persuasive.
Very good. And the evidence is sitting right here. What did you, if not Polity, what did you hope to accomplish once you said, okay, I'm writing it?
I wanted to use this book as an opportunity to let people know how fast China is changing. So for many years, the U.S. government, the Senate or the Congress, refused to take action on climate because they said China, or many said, China isn't doing anything, so why should we act? And it's just been the past 5 years, I would say, that China has begun this dramatic transformation towards clean energy, towards becoming the world leader in solar energy and wind energy, in electric vehicles, and in green finance. And a lot of it is triggered by the fact that the previous development model of coal-fired heavy industry, manufacturing center for the world, was just unsustainable. And in 2013, the air pollution got so bad that people were calling it the air-pocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
It was as if every man, woman, and child in China was smoking 1.5 cigarettes every hour. And an estimated 4,000 people were dying every day from the air pollution. Now, what's causing that air pollution? The same thing that's causing China's CO2, 80% of China's CO2 emissions. It's coal. And so because of that air apocalypse, China began to, for the first time, to really target coal consumption and cutting coal use in its key, most polluted regions.
Okay, now, that exchange with Jared Diamond that I referred to in the introduction, when we said, you know, the leaders decide we're going to take action, and action happens. And you know, we said, well, there's there's an ambivalence then about the what happens under authoritarian rule. Something similar here. I mean, when you state the pivot that China took and the amount of energy, I'm talking about intellectual and human energy, and the amount of subsidies. That once they decided we're taking this seriously, the action was swift and kind of unprecedented in the history of the world. Speak a little bit about that, about the nature of the forces of power in China and how that equipped them to make such a rapid pivot.
China has a different political system than ours, obviously, and one of the things that they have is a system where all of the provincial governors and the city mayors actually report to the Beijing central government. So that is one way in which the government can issue edicts like this major 1.7 trillion renminbi air pollution control action plan and just set quotas for each province to cut its coal use and to cut its air pollution. We don't have that ability so much in the United States except through national laws like the Clean Air Act. But it's important to note also that local governments have a saying in China, and it says, the mountain is high and the emperor is far away.
Mm.
So one reason we saw coal use, even though it may have actually peaked 4 years ago, starting to creep up again because local governments resist, in many cases, edicts from the central government if they don't think it's in their own self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
And let's remember that many of these local governments, these cities, these provinces, were built on the coal economy. They provide jobs, coal provides tax revenues, and it's not easy to switch away from that. So when the government was closing down a lot of coal plants and requiring them to meet these mandatory caps on coal consumption, many times the local government would get around, find ways to get around that. So that's one of the, or start up the plants when the government wasn't looking. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the key obstacles to moving forward that many people aren't aware of.
Right. We're going to talk about the challenges in a moment. But again, going to this notion of authoritarianism and rapid change, how does it work? One thing that I believe is true, and you tell me if I'm right or wrong, that a lot of the leadership in China, rather than in America, where a lot of the political leadership is lawyers, no offense, Barbara, a lot of the leadership in China is engineers. Am I correct?
That's correct. That's correct. And what's been so interesting for me is to watch the debate, this really substantive debate that goes on among all these government officials and also the experts in research institutes and universities that advise the government on what their next five-year plan should be. People, again, think it's all monolithic. It just comes down from the top. But it really is a group of very highly trained, often engineers and scientists, working together to try and figure out what can China do and how do we get there.
Right. And so would I be kind of correct when we're talking again about these local officials? And people have to remember, the country has a population of over a billion people and stretches over enormous distances, as that proverb, you know, implies. But they had one way of living for a long time. And then they shifted to rapid growth, as you say. The entrance into the WTO really enabled them to get into foreign markets, enabled them to become the manufacturing center for the world. And basically it was, you'll have money, you'll have a change in your standard of living, your city and your province will get richer, people will have goodies that they used to just dream about, and you won't have democracy. And what happened, if I'm not mistaken, is come the time of the apocalypse and so on, is that wasn't enough. And now it became, okay, you'll have money and you'll have a quality of life. We're going to begin to move into a quality of life. And my guess is that some of those local provinces and some of those local leaders went, wait a minute, this has worked. This has worked for me. Changing is threatening.
That's absolutely right. The government decided, and the people decided, that it's one thing to become rich, but not if you have to wear a face mask to go outside, not if you have your one child suffering from asthma, not if the rivers turn colors depending upon the color that's in fashion in Western clothing. They had to have a better life. And so, yes, the government has been really doing an about-face in trying to figure out how to come up with a continued economic development in a way that's sustainable.
I mean, it's interesting. It looks to me like what they've done is they've compressed the evolution of economies in the West into a much shorter time frame. In other words, we went through that same sort of thing. If we go back to, you mentioned the first Earth Day, 1970, the Cayuga River outside, you know, adjacent to Cleveland on fire, things like that. So we had that moment when we said, wait a minute, you know, being the manufacturing center of the world has its costs, and shifted. And what it seems that China does is it goes through these phases much, much more quickly.
That's right. They have begun to clean up at a stage in their development that's much faster than any other country in history. And part of it is that the technology, the clean technology, is available now.
That's
that
right.
Wasn't available for example, the United States or the UK. And a lot of the reason it's available is that China has put so much investment into clean technologies that they have brought down those costs for themselves and for the entire world.
Right. So they're that mixed economy, market, but hugely driven by industrial plans and subsidies in a way we remember when Obama came into office and we're in that economic crisis and we need a stimulus plan. And I'll just cite, well, one thing I remember was, I think he dropped like $40 billion of that stimulus plan that was going to go directly to the states because Republicans squawked. He ends up with a smaller stimulus plan than needed, although it was probably the biggest clean energy initiative the U.S. had ever seen, without calling it that. But the compromises involved meant that it wasn't what it could be. Over there, the subsidies are mind-boggling.
That's right. And just for an example of what you cite is the power of authoritarian governments to move quickly. So when the 2008 economic crisis hit globally, China was already the largest producer of solar panels worldwide, but it was almost all for export. But with that economic crisis, these countries like Germany were stopping their subsidies. And so the bottom dropped out of China's market. And it decided it needed to develop a domestic solar energy industry. And within 10 years, it was the leading solar, in terms of solar panel capacity domestically, in the world.
So it went from just being the largest producer to being the largest consumer.
Right. And now one-third of all solar panels and one-third of all wind turbines in the world are in China. And once again, it's fundamentally changed the economics of these clean energy technologies throughout the world. It's brought the price down by nearly three-quarters in just 10 years.
Mm, phenomenal. Let me tell people, by the way, that you're listening to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Barbara Finnemore. She's a senior attorney and Asia Senior Strategic Director at the Natural Resources Defense Council, the NRDC. And we're talking about the ideas in her book, Will China Save the Planet? And you can learn more at nrdc.org or, for specifically issues related to China, nrdc.cn. And I think you mentioned to me that if you go to nrdc.cn, you originally will come up with a website in Chinese, but you can easily shift it to English.
Thank you.
Okay, very good. Hello, this is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my 2019 conversation with Barbara Finnemore about her provocative book, Will China Save the Planet?, which explores China's big-picture, long-term strategy to reap the technological, economic, and political benefits of seizing leadership of the global response to climate change. Briefly summarize the findings of the fourth National Climate Assessment delivered this previous November, sort of to set the baseline of where we are and what's needed in terms of climate change.
This report is a wake-up call for the entire planet. We used to think that if we could reduce global warming to 2 degrees Celsius, it would be safe. But now we understand that we really need to get that growth down to 1.5 degrees centigrade to bring the impacts of climate change to what they call mostly survivable levels. And in order to do that, we have to dramatically change our global clean energy economy, the ways in which we use and store and obtain energy at a way that, at a speed and a scale that we've never, ever experienced in the world. And if we don't, every aspect of our life on Earth will be worse than we could ever anticipate, to summarize briefly.
Yeah, there you go. And let's talk again fairly briefly here, but the contrast since the election of Donald Trump between China and the U.S. I'm going to read a quote because I went back and found some of the articles or blog posts that you did around the time of that election. And you say, under President Trump, the United States has shamefully stalled on the very real climate progress that was made during the Obama administration. And in June of 2017, you wrote, by recklessly withdrawing from the Paris Agreement, Trump has ceded the race for global leadership to China. And were you speaking in that second quote of global leadership in confronting climate change or global leadership per se?
I'm talking about climate change.
Okay.
I'm talking about climate change. When Trump announced his intention to withdraw from the Paris Agreement in 2020, China seized on the opportunity to announce that it was going to continue to move ahead with its own climate actions, regardless of what the second largest emitter in the world does. This was a chance for China to kind of, seize the reins and enhance its international image. But to be honest with you, China does not want to act alone. It was very comfortable in signing a series of bilateral agreements with the U.S. that really paved the way for the Paris Agreement. And we saw that again just this week, when China, the Chinese government, and the French government, and the UN Secretary General issued a joint declaration committing China and France to increasing their ambition and strengthening their Paris climate targets, and also publishing a low-carbon plan for 2050 in the near future. So China is, again, using this opportunity, I think, to show its climate leadership and shame the United States.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I know that the your real answer to the question is, will China save the planet, is not by itself, right?
Yes, that's right.
Right.
That's right.
And I think probably we don't recall that much how, while we, you know, we oppose China's form of government, we look askance at what it does in terms of surveillance, and we're fighting it in terms of what it wants out of our tech companies and so on, there was kind of unprecedented cooperation between the Obama administration and China. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? Because I don't think it was like headline news, because it's just not that kind of thing.
There were a lot of tensions between the Obama administration and China. And government officials have said to me on several occasions that actually climate change cooperation was perhaps the only bright spot in collaboration between the two countries. And they made tremendous progress during that time in a series of climate change working groups where the two countries worked on everything together, from how do you monitor and verify greenhouse gas emissions to how do you build the clean cars of the future. And that's what we've lost today. That's what we've lost today. That's what I'm hoping we can bring back, because it's in every country's self-interest, especially the U.S. and China, to work together to accelerate the transition to clean energy, to develop markets that goes beyond countries' borders, and to give strong signals to the industry that the only way forward for them to make a profit is to put their money in clean energy too.
Okay, let me make a couple of points. One is Yuval Noah Harari, the author of Sapiens and other books. In his book, 21 Lessons for the 21st Century, and I interviewed him on this, he makes the point that he believes the three greatest threats facing humanity are climate change, the possibility of nuclear war, and technological disruption, something that happens through artificial intelligence, something. And he points out that those three problems, all of which have an existential quality to them, demand cooperation. That at a time when we see what's happening in the U.S. and we see what's happening in Europe in terms of right-wing populism and so on, that ultimately the real problems that humans face demand cooperation, collaboration, and that's at the root of everything you're talking about as well, correct?
That's correct. And my view is that despite what we think of China's government and of what it's doing in other areas, and there's a lot of concerns, as we know, I don't think we have any choice but to collaborate and cooperate with China on climate change for the very reasons you've described. And I think the U.S. military understands it. The Department of Defense has called climate change a threat multiplier, which increases the severity of all threats to our national security. And so even if you go beyond the demonstrated impacts that we're already seeing in climate change, like Washington, D.C., this week, dumping almost a month's worth of rain in just one morning, or Anchorage, Alaska, reaching 90 degrees, more than New York City. You know, even if you go beyond it, just to keep our national security together requires that type of cooperation on climate change.
Right. And it used to be the thinking, I believe, was engagement with China. This goes back to Nixon opening, visiting China, that engagement would lead to a change in their political system. And I think we have seen that that hasn't really happened. However, what you're saying is that on an issue like climate change, and I would guess on those others as well, we will see over time, that you have to say, well, even if it's not going to change our political system, it's an existential global crisis, and we need to collaborate.
I would agree. I would agree completely. And you know, people tend to move from one extreme to the other to China's not doing anything,
yeah,
to China's eating our lunch on solar energy and wind power and electric vehicles, so there's nothing we can do. The same thing with climate change. It's not happening on one hand. The next day, there's far beyond anything we can do. That's not the case. The U.S. still leads the world in innovation capacity, and we can help to develop the next generation of all these clean energies technologies probably better than any other country in the world. But we can't do that if the Trump administration continues to try to slash funding mm-hmm. for those offices that fund these yep. innovative researchers.
Yeah, and we're not even talking about the kinds of massive subsidies you need for execution and implementation. We're talking about the research money you need for innovation.
Right. And even with respect to those subsidies, what we're finding now, this is what gives me hope that that clean energy transition is already underway, is that China's subsidies and its procurement efforts, its R&D, they brought that cost down for solar and wind so much that now they are phasing out subsidies.
That's right.
For solar and wind. They're requiring them to compete with coal head-to-head, and they are winning.
Right. They had regulation with subsidies, and now they're finding that regulation alone is probably going to be the path forward in a lot of these avenues.
Right. And even with electric vehicles, they're phasing out those subsidies, which were 10 times those in the U.S. And last year, for the first time, the sales of traditional gas-guzzling cars in China dropped, while the sales of these electric vehicles continues to soar. So the transition is happening.
Okay. Now, this is kind of a big notion, and I tried to do a little bit of research, and I couldn't come up. But I can remember in the last few years, a wise person wrote that world leadership shifts with the globe's primary source of energy, that Holland, Portugal, Italy were dominant in the age of wind, that Britain was dominant in the age of steam, that U.S. was dominant in the age of oil. And it seems to me that when Trump withdraws from the Paris Accords, China sees a gift that it could be the leader in the age of renewables. What do you think of that kind of analysis?
I think that's very wise. It is happening, and it's interesting to put it in the context of what has happened with other countries with different types of energy. But yes, China is not only hoping to become the world leader in renewable energy, it is far and away the largest emitter. By next year, China will have four times as many solar panels than the United States, and it's only going up. So, yes, it's seizing that opportunity, just like the other countries that you mentioned.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me just read a couple of statistics from your book. Last year, China added more solar photovoltaic capacity than the rest of the world combined. If China meets its 2020 targets, it will by then have installed five times the solar capacity that the U.S. had in 2017. For every dollar that the United States invested in renewable energy last year, China invested three. Last year, it invested $126 billion. By 2020, it will have spent another $300, and that was written in, that was a year ago. By 2020, it will have spent another $360 billion. And by 2030, a dozen years from now, it will have spent $6 trillion on solar, wind, and other forms of clean energy. China recently overtook the United States as the world's largest market for electric vehicles, accounting for nearly half the global total in 2017. It's home to 40% of the world's electric cars, 99% of all electric buses. Talk about that for a second, because I found that an interesting point that, yeah, they dominate in electric cars, but in buses, they're almost singularly, and that's putting two pathways together, isn't it? One, we want to be in clean energy, but two, we want to be in shared transportation.
Yes, I think China understands that it's not going to be enough if they move all their private cars to electric vehicles. They're clogging the roads right now. People can't move with cars. They have to move to shared vehicles, electric buses, electric vehicles, and also shared vehicles. And so it was really one company in China called BYD, Build Your Dreams, that started to make electric buses a few years ago. They're in the southern city of Shenzhen. And Shenzhen, once these these buses were available, decided not just to replace buses that were at the end of their useful life and put in electric. They decided to convert their entire fleet to electric buses. And many, many other cities in China have done the same. And just in May of this year, the central government, and this is another example
yes.
of how they can move local governments, the central government required every local government, every city in China, to develop a plan for completely phasing out gas-guzzling buses. They're going to completely move the whole country to electric buses.
Yeah,
and China's the largest vehicle market in the world, so that's not that's saying a lot.
Yeah, and one thing you point out is that the normal way, even once you say we're going clean, in the U.S., for instance, is when a bus goes out of commission, you replace it with a clean energy bus. And what you're saying is that they said, no, we're not going to wait for the combustion engine buses to die. We're going to just sideline them and replace them before that happens.
Yes, and this company, BYD, has now a big bus production facility in California, and they're selling electric buses in this country as well and to other countries because, they can achieve economies of scale that other countries don't.
Right. Once you put innovation into motion, and once you back it up with regulation and or subsidies, on the scale of the size of a populace like China, you are doing what other countries can only dream of in terms of what you were just talking about, lowering the price, right? I mean, on their own, they can lower the global price of just about anything.
Yes. Yes. That's one of the reasons why I asked that question, will China save the planet? Because of what it's done to bring the price down of these clean energy technologies worldwide.
Right, that even if it ends up being that America comes back to the fold, which we hope happens sooner than later, and the rest of the world takes it on, that what they have done has accelerated what is possible for anyone else to do.
That's right, and then you have a situation where Trump is imposing tariffs on importation of solar panels with, you know, the reasoning that this will bring back solar manufacturing to the United States. That is backfiring. What he's not brought solar manufacturing back to the United States because what China has done is build factories that are four times the size of anything we could have in the U.S. They're largely automated, so they don't come up with new jobs. These tariffs have eaten into jobs in the United States because until the tariffs came around, the fastest growing job in the United States was, guess what?
Solar
panel
yeah,
installer.
Exactly. And that's a job you can't, if you're installing solar panels, you cannot send that job overseas. It happens where the house is. It happens where the building is.
Right.
Yeah, and you point out that China leads the world in clean energy jobs. In 2016, it was 3.64 million. And then with all that spending that I was talking about, it's only going to grow. And so this notion that getting out of the Paris Agreement or putting tariffs on solar panels is going to help America's jobs is just... I mean, the thing that strikes me, and I alluded to it in the intro, is that we are the... quote, democratic country, the rule of the people, and yet one person winning an electoral college victory can change our position vis-a-vis China, but can change the whole world's progress.
Yes, that's true. But I should point out that the fossil fuel industry is strong in both the United States and in China, and their, you know, support for various political candidates is a key part of our problem. And even without elections in China, the resistance of China's fossil fuel industry to change is another serious obstacle that we are trying hard to help them overcome.
Okay, let's talk about the challenges. We've got about 10 more minutes. It's all sounded really good. What are the challenges? I mean, we've talked about what China's achieving. What are the challenges it faces to continue this progress, accelerate this progress, et cetera?
One of the challenges is the competition between coal, which is actually being phased out around the world because it's no longer economic, and renewable energy, the upstart on the block, which is becoming cheaper and cheaper, but still has to fight a battle with a powerful incumbent. And we're seeing this in China. The rules of the grid are set up in such a way that coal, if you were to build a coal plant in China, regardless of whether it's needed, and no new coal plants are needed in China because the existing ones only run half of the time, if you were to build a new coal plant in China, you're guaranteed a certain number of operating hours, and you're guaranteed a fixed price, regardless of the availability of cheaper alternatives. So this power grid is not only weighed in favor of coal, but it's still kind of a 20th century grid. It's not flexible enough to allow it to integrate all these variable resources like solar and wind. That's a big problem in many countries, but particularly in China, because they were built on that coal economy. Mm-hmm. That's one of the biggest ones. And the second one is, again, this fossil fuel industry dragging its feet. And so what we're finding is as China starts to crack down on coal consumption domestically, it is still the largest financier of coal infrastructure overseas in its Belt and Road initiative. And that's, again, in my mind, a sign of the power of the fossil fuel industry. They want to keep going, even though many of them have switched and are adding in renewable energy like BP, Beyond Petroleum. They're still a very, very powerful force in China. China has an enormous opportunity in these countries where it's building infrastructure overseas, it's called the Belt and Road Initiative, it has an enormous opportunity to share its technology, its expertise, its policies on how to promote renewable energy like it's done domestically. We're still seeing it's China, Japan, and Korea, the leading supporters and financiers of coal plants overseas. So China has said it's going to restrict coal lending and it's going to green the Belt and Road Initiative, and we're one of the groups that's working with them to try and put, you know, mandatory standards on the books that will ensure that it does so.
And what's your analysis of why the progress internationally with China's money and China's initiatives lags behind the progress domestically? Is it that the directives set goals and so on domestically, and they're just a little more lax on what they're doing internationally, and so there the fossil fuel industry gets to put its thumb on the scale more easily?
Yes, it's in part due to the fact that the recipient countries don't often have the strong environmental rules in place to ensure that when they have, you know, loans for energy, it's for clean energy. They don't have the grid capacity. China's built all that high-level transmission lines. It can help these other countries do the same, but many of them are not there yet. And also, when China signs contracts with these countries for coal infrastructure, it provides a lot of jobs for Chinese workers, and often they share in the profits. Whereas for renewable energy investment, it's really the private market that's, whether it be private companies in China or elsewhere, that's driving investment in renewable energy, because that makes the most market sense.
So the vested interests in the recipient countries, as well as the vested interest in the fossil fuel industry, make it harder to make as much progress.
Now, I never thought of that. That's very true.
Yeah.
It's true all over the world.
Yeah. It is the thing that I always think, that when, an old regime, whether it's a political, cultural, or economic, or industrial, the whoever's leading the old regime is in the highest position of power, and they can always be a drag on the interloper, on the innovator. They've got more money to lobby, more money to spend, more money for corruption.
Yes.
What about China's carbon trading efforts? How are they doing?
So they launched the program, I think it was December of 2017, and it's huge. It's a huge undertaking. Remember, as you said, China is not a market economy at this point. So it's trying to use a market mechanism of carbon trading to cut its CO2 emissions. And in order to do so, it really needs to ensure that the fundamental building blocks of any trading system are in place, like transparency, like enforcement, and like strong monitoring and verification procedures. So China's in the process of doing that, and I should point out that other countries like the United States, well, not the country, but states and regions
California.
In the United States who've developed carbon trading programs and also the EU have taken years to do the same. So this is not something that can happen overnight. But China decided to focus initially on the power sector. And just by focusing on this one sector, once it's actually underway, this could result in the largest carbon trading market in the world. But it needs that power sector reform that I talked about earlier as another fundamental building block if the carbon trading system is going to work.
Very good. Let me ask you, we've got about 3 minutes. We've already sort of said, will China save the planet? Not by itself. What gives you the most hope and what gives you the most concern or fear? And you can talk beyond China. I'm talking about you. You obviously are looking at climate change and you're looking at the whole globe, but you're looking at China, the U.S., et cetera. The most hope, the most fear.
What's given me the most hope is that China's investments and its policies that I've described on clean technology have moved the ball ahead so fast that we're in a position where we could reach, as a globe, 50% electric vehicles by 2050, two-thirds renewable energy, and so forth. This would never have happened, in my mind, without China's input. However, what gives me the most concern is it's nowhere near fast enough. The report from the UN scientists last November says we need to increase our investment in renewable energy six times what it already has. We need to invest $2.4 trillion every year between now and 2030. And most of that has to come from the private sector. So unless we act really fast, we have to phase out coal pretty much completely and electrify everything. These are huge, huge calls for change that require everybody.
Okay. And what lessons can we learn from China?
Well, I think, again, industrial policy has been a dirty word, a dirty phrase in the United States for decades. But in my mind, China has used industrial policy in a very positive way. It's coming up with long-term goals, standards, targets, subsidies, procurement, and a whole comprehensive package for each of these clean energy technologies. That's something that we can learn a lot from.
Okay. And I mean, and you know, anybody who talks about the Green New Deal, for instance, that is industrial policy. And they harken back to World War II. When we needed to shift from a peacetime to a wartime economy, we did it fast and we did it. And to some extent, everybody won. And you point out the number of jobs that that China is gaining by what it's doing. And so it seems to me that sort of an approach, hopefully, we will begin to see. So again, the book is Will China Save the Planet? The website is nrdc.org, or for the China program specifically, nrdc.cn. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or worldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website, terrencemcnally.net, or one long phrase, a world that just might work.com. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 to 10 articles to sort of flesh out the conversation, you can sign up at my site, or you can email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, etc., or at my site. You can find years of podcasts at my site. Listen anytime, anywhere. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to G. Lee and Mark Maxwell in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. And thank you, Barbara Fenimore. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. My pleasure.
911, what's your emergency?
America's healthcare system is broken and people are dying.
Welcome to Code WAC, where we shine a light on America's callous healthcare system, how it hurts us, and what we can do about it. I'm your host, Brenda Gazar. This time on Code WEC. How does running a hospital like a business run counter to providing reliable and affordable healthcare? How would having Medicare for All change the way hospitals are financed? And what would it mean for patients, doctors, and the hospitals themselves? To find out, we spoke to Dr. David Himmelstein, a distinguished professor of public health at CUNY's Hunter College and a lecturer in medicine at Harvard Medical School. He also serves as a staff physician at Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx. Welcome back to Code WEC, Dr. Himmelstein.
Thanks for having me.
In 1987, you co-founded Physicians for a National Health Program. What inspired you to do that?
Well, the experiences of our healthcare system really making it so difficult to care for patients, and many of my patients at public hospitals where I work being unable to get the care they needed and deserved. At the same time, seeing that our country had ample resources to provide excellent care to everyone if they were distributed in a reasonable way. I mean, I spent some of my time during my career working at fancy private hospitals. During my residency, 1 or 2 months, we rotated through a fancy private hospital, and 1 month a year I used to be the attending physician, the staff physician on the wards at Mass General Hospital, one of Harvard's banner teaching hospitals. So I saw excellent care that was available to privileged patients, and often resources at those hospitals that went unused because the hospitals actually oftentimes had surplus resources. And meantime, the public hospitals where I spent most of my time working, patients weren't getting the care they needed. So my partner, Steffi Wohlhandler, and I looked around at what alternatives there were for how to finance healthcare, and we saw that other countries really did it better, and they had lessons to teach us about how you could construct a healthcare financing system that was both fairer, more efficient, and improved health outcomes.
Can you give an example?
We particularly looked at Canada because Canada's healthcare system in many ways is very, very similar to that in the U.S. And in fact, until we passed Medicare and Medicaid in the mid-1960s and Canada passed its national health insurance scheme around that same time, our healthcare systems and financing systems were almost identical. So it was easy to see how we could make a transition to a national health insurance scheme like Canada, which is not perfect, but has huge advantages. So we really used that as an initial model and thought about what it would take to transition the U.S.
Can you explain how hospitals are financed today and how they would be paid under Medicare for All?
Well, at this point, hospitals bill patients or their insurance plans for each hospital stay generally. And depending on what the insurance is, they may get more or less. So a patient with pneumonia with insurance from a private insurance plan, generally the hospital gets paid more than the same patient if they're covered by Medicare, and much more than if that patient is covered by Medicaid. And if they're uninsured, the hospital will bill the patient themselves and try and collect from them. And sometimes hospitals get some money for uninsured patients from government funds. So there are multiple streams of payment. There's private insurance, there's Medicaid, there's Medicare, and patients themselves, both the uninsured, and then co-payments and deductibles that patients have to pay, even if they are insured in many cases. So one impact of that is that some patients bring in more money than other patients do. If you have private insurance, you're going to get, the hospital gets paid more than if you have Medicare, and Medicare more than if you have Medicaid, and in most cases, either of those more than if you're uninsured. Single payer would really change that in two ways. One is everyone would have the same insurance, so there'd be no distinction among patients, so there'd be no more for Sally than for Alice. And that's one important piece. But the second is, in countries like Canada, where everyone has the same insurance, generally hospitals don't bill for each patient and each time they're admitted. They get paid one lump sum amount each month for their operation, much like a fire department gets paid in the U.S. So the Canadians and people in many other countries have said, why would we bother trying to figure out how much it costs to care for Sally and how much it costs to care for Alice? Our concern is, what does it cost to run the hospital and take care of everybody whom they take care of? So we'll just pay the hospital a lump sum, and that eliminates a huge amount of paperwork, both for the hospital and for the organization doing the payer. So for the hospital, it means you don't have to keep track of who got every Band-Aid and aspirin tablet, try and figure out what you can squeeze out of each patient's care. And for the payer, it means, again, you don't have to pay for that stuff and go over each of those bills in that kind of detail.
I see. Thank you, Dr. David Himmelstein. Do you have a personal story you'd like to share about our WAC healthcare system? contact us through our website at heal-ca.org. Don't forget to subscribe to Code WAC wherever you find your podcasts. You can also find us on progressivevoices.com and on Nurse Talk Media. Code WAC is powered by Heal California, uplifting the voices of those fighting for healthcare reform around the country. I'm Brenda Gazar.